The day after the rally, Marty decided it was time for me to do some real work, and he handed me a long list of people to interview. Find out their self-interest, he said. That's why people become involved in organizing, because they think they'll get something out of it. Once I found an issue enough people cared about, I could take them into action. With enough actions, I could start to build power. I was worried at first about people's willingness to meet and talk with me, but after a few phone calls, I found that people didn't mind a chance to air their opinions about a do-nothing alderman or the neighbor who refused to mow his lawn. The more interviews I did, the more I began to hear certain recurring themes. I learned, for example, that most of the people in the area had been raised farther north, or on Chicago's west side, in the cramped black enclaves the restrictive covenants had created for most of the city's history. The people I talked to had some fond memories of that self-contained world, but they also remembered the absence of heat and light and space to breathe. That, and the sight of their parents grinding out life in physical labor. A few had followed their parents into the steel mills or onto the assembly line, but many more had found jobs as mail carriers, bus drivers, teachers, and social workers, taking advantage of the more rigorous enforcement of anti-discrimination laws in the public sector. Such jobs had benefits and provided enough security to think about taking on a mortgage. With the passage of fair housing laws, they began to buy homes, one at a time, in Roseland and other white neighborhoods. Not because they were necessarily interested in mingling with whites, they insisted, but because the houses there were affordable, with small yards for their children, because the schools were better and the stores cheaper, and maybe just because they could. Often, as I listened to these stories, I would find myself reminded of the stories that Gramps and Toot and my mother had told, stories of hardship and migration, the drive for something better. But there was an inescapable difference between what I was hearing now and what I remembered, as if the images of my childhood had been run in reverse. In these new stories, for sale signs cropped up like dandelions under a summer sun. Stones flew through windows, and the strained voices of anxious parents could be heard calling children indoors from innocent games. Entire blocks turned over in less than 6 months. Entire neighborhoods in less than 5 years. In these stories, wherever black and white met, the result was sure to be anger and grief. The area had never fully recovered from this racial upheaval. The stores and banks had left with their white customers, causing main thoroughfares to decompose. City services had declined. Still, when the blacks who now lived in their homes for 10 or 15 years looked back on the way things had turned out, they did so with some measure of satisfaction. On the strength of two incomes, they had paid off house notes and car notes, maybe college educations, for the sons or daughters whose graduation pictures filled every mantelpiece. They had kept their homes up and kept their children off the streets. They had formed block clubs to make sure that others did too. It was when they spoke of the future that a certain disquiet entered their voices. They would mention a cousin or sibling who came by every so often asking for money, or an adult child, unemployed, who still lived at home. Even the success of those children who'd made it through college and into the white-collar world harbored within it an element of loss. The better these children did, the more likely they were to move away. In their place, younger, less stable families moved in. The second wave of migrants from poorer neighborhoods, newcomers who couldn't always afford to keep up with their mortgage payments or invest in periodic maintenance. Car thefts were up. The leafy parks were empty. People began to spend more time inside. They invested in elaborate wrought iron doors. They wondered if they could afford to sell at a loss and retire to a warmer climate, perhaps move back to the South. So despite the deserved sense of accomplishment these men and women felt, despite the irrefutable evidence of their own progress, our conversations were marked by another, more ominous strain. The boarded-up homes, the decaying storefronts, the aging church rolls, kids from unknown families who swaggered down the streets, loud congregations of teenage boys, teenage girls feeding potato chips to crying toddlers, the discarded wrappers tumbling down the block, all of it whispered painful truths, told them the progress they'd found was ephemeral, rooted in thin soil, that it might not even last their lifetimes. And it was this dual sense of individual advancement and collective decline that I thought accounted for some of the most troubling attitudes I heard in some conversations. I heard it in the excessive pride some of the men took at their well-stocked bars they'd built in their basements, with the lava lamps and the mirrored walls, in the protective plastic that the women kept over their spotless carpets and sofas. In all of it, one saw a determined effort to shore up the belief that things had in fact changed, if only some people would start acting right. "I try to avoid driving through Rosen when I can," a woman from neighboring Washington Heights explained to me one evening. "People down there are just rougher. You can see it in the way they keep up their homes. You didn't see things like that when the white folks still lived there." Distinctions between neighborhoods, then blocks, then finally neighbors within a block. Attempts to cordon off, control the decay. One thing I noticed, though. The woman so concerned with the cruder habits of her neighbors had a picture of Harold in her kitchen, right next to the sampler of the 23rd Psalm. So did the young man who lived in the crumbling apartment a few blocks away and was trying to make ends meet by mixing records at dance parties. As it had for the men in Smitty's barbershop, the election had given both these people a new idea of themselves. Or maybe it was an old idea, born of a simpler time. Harold was something they held in common. Like my idea of organizing, he held out an offer of collective redemption.